always exist. So we are not surprised to find in the name of Moses the secret concealed name of the sun deity. We are inevitably likely to find this. Moses was a light bearer. Moses was a light giver to his people. That they should have honored him by representing him symbolically as a kind of sun rising out of darkness would only be appropriate to what we generally know already, or what we already have reason to explain or understand in these religious beliefs. The life of Moses, therefore, has to do with Israel, with the descent of a chosen people, and with the emergence of himself as an archetypal symbol of the Mosaic Law. He is the law. He is the law personified or embodied. He is strangely and wonderfully expresses not only its depth but its limitations. He is the revealer and he is the statement of the revelation. And as you study his relation to the structure of the Pentateuch, you become more and more convinced that you are dealing with a principle rather than essentially a person. Now, this does not mean that we deny that the person lives. But we also know that even in Christianity, this particular situation has dynamically arisen. In the 4th century, one of the popes said that the 25th day of December is not so sacred for the birth of Jesus as for the annual birth of the Son. We know also that the birth of Jesus was made to coincide with the winter solstice at a considerably later time than we would first imagine. We realize that all of these stories finally do tie with an astronomical phenomenon that was noted and recorded at a very early date by primitive people, most of whom were involved in what we call astrology, or the religion of the stars, the religion of the bodies moving in the heavens. This fact is clearly indicated in the vision of Ezekiel and in parts of the vision of Isaiah and many others of the early prophetic and literary books of the Bible. Moses, therefore, must be understood as representing the archetypal concept of law. He is the law. And the story of Moses is the story of the law unfolding in a people. And it is also the story of the revelation of a great moral code. A code that not only we should examine, but the basic reason for which we should try to understand. Now with Moses, as with most of the other characters which are involved in the Old Testament story, we see a descent also of beliefs and tradition. Moses found in the bulrushes. Moses raised in the land of Egypt, which is the symbol of darkness, always in the biblical account. The same as the city of Babylon in the stories or the famous theological writings of St. Augustine. Always the city of Egypt represents matter, darkness, ignorance, materiality. It represents the same in the story of the prodigal son, which is another example of the same basic idea. The prodigal son goes into the land of Egypt and wastes his substance in riotous living, and finally returns to his father's house, where he is forgiven and the fatted calf is offered for him. These stories all have to do with the cycle of life and the cycle of the revelation of consciousness and form. And on that psychological level, they are tremendously important. Now, if you will look back at the different doctrines and beliefs, and even the fairy tales and legends that you have enjoyed and known through the years, you will find the constant repetition of the Moses figure. The Moses figure is simply the angel. We always think of it in the magnificent form he is represented in the statue by Michelangelo. We see this great bearded angel. He looks almost like the proverbial concept of God himself. We see him leading his people through the mysteries of the wilderness. We see him leading them out of Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, and all of these stories which will later have much more meaning to us. we find him also bringing them ultimately to the promised land. And there, on the lonely hill of Moab, this great teacher and leader of his people lies down to sleep with his father. He is not allowed to enter into the promised land because of a sin which he committed, because he broke the faith of God, because he broke the tablets of the law, and because he doubted when he struck the rock with his wand. For these things he might not enter in, but he was permitted to see this land of promise from the mountain. And then he went to sleep with the angel. And the place knew him no more, and his body was never found. This interesting parallel in story is itself a very interesting and wonderful story. In the Jewish legendary and lore, it is said that God did not send the angel of death to receive to itself the soul of Moses. The Lord came himself and took him home. And this is the concept behind this very strange and deep and wonderful story. But who was it that led the children of Israel into the promised land? It was Jehoshua, the son of Nun. Now, what is Jehoshua, the son of Nun? If you write it in Hebrew, you have exactly the same thing as Jesus, the son of the fish. Because the word Nun means fish. The earliest sign of the Christian was fish drawn on the sand, known long before even the Christian community knew there was such a thing as a cross associated with their religion. So the sign of the fish was the ancient symbol of recognition. And the words of the name of Jesus himself becomes, according to St. Augustine, a mysterious cabal by using the first letter. We find that from his name comes the name of the fish. We also know that the papal ring is the fisherman's ring, that the great fisherman was the one upon whose foundation the church was built, and that there was a mysterious coin or gold of great merit that was found in the fish's mouth. All these legends are interesting, especially when you tie them to Jehoshua, the son of Nun, who must lead the children of Israel along the 49th road of the great Sefer Yetzirah into the promised land. When Jesus passed through, for Moses passed through 49 gates of the mystery, but only Jesus passed through the 50th, according to the early development of the Christian thought. So these things all have their stories, and they all have their involved and intricate and important and wonderful meaning. So we'll follow the life of Moses, but we will follow it a little indirectly, because I want to tie it more directly with the story of the books themselves, with which we have to have a certain amount of consideration. Now, as we've told you, the book of Genesis, by the representation of the nature of creation, by making a definite statement of the outworkings and unfoldings of the divine will, and how these unfoldings were frustrated by the temptation of Eden, the fall of man, and the exile from the garden, and how as a result of this exile, man was forced to go forth and earn his bread with the sweat of his brow, and how later we find the tragedy of Cain and Abel and the birth of Seth and the foundation of priesthood. All of these we find because we know that Israel was not only a person, a tribe, but it was also an epitome of the ancient Jewish concept of all humanity. Israel was humanity, was not essentially originally a race or a nation. It only gradually developed into this as the national pride, national existence took more and more definite shape and form in the minds of the people. But in Genesis, then, we have the foundations of the Pentateuchal dispensation, the law and the prophets. We have the concept arising in this that religion is obedience to law. That therefore, man worships God by keeping the covenant of God. And that which is pleasing under the law brings with it the security and peace of man. Thus we have a very definite statement that religion is keeping the divine plan keeping the laws that God has created. Now, where these laws exist, and they are affirmed to exist in Genesis, and we see the gradual unfoldment of these laws, it becomes obvious to anyone that laws can't exist without them knowing what they are. And that when we have been admonished to keep a law, we may be at a sovereign disadvantage. We may not know what the law is. Well, that is not uncommon even in our day of life. There are many people who say, what is good? We simply are not sure. We are not certain of what degree our own judgment, our own patterns, even our general acceptances, our traditions, our creeds, and our codes are true. We do not know. Therefore, the admonition to keep the law must inevitably require the revelation of that law. Someone must know it. And the creation of this concept, that man must keep the statutes, immediately requires the emergence of the lawgiver. We have not the evidence or proof that these laws are so visibly written that primitive man can understand them. In fact, they are not so visibly written that modern man can understand them. He sees phases, aspects, parts of them, but he is not certain of their totality. He is not certain of what is good in this situation or what is bad in that situation. Thus, the moment we have the revelation, the fiat of the divine being, we then naturally and inevitably are faced with the problem, what is truth? What is the law? How and where should we experience or find the law? So we find in Genesis the beginning of this problem, the statement of it, the gradual unfolding of certain of its basic principles. But we do not yet have the full statement of it. So in the Exodus, which is the second group, the second book of this group, we find the gradual unfoldment of the law. And we find that the law unfolded in Exodus just as it unfolds in the life of the human being. It unfolds through the gradual enrichment of man's experience. It unfolds through historical perspective. It develops through time and circumstance. And especially under the emergency of great and pressing need, during and under which condition there is greater demand for integrity, greater reliance upon truth. So that the Exodus carries the children of Israel in the long road which leads to the integration of their society, their integration nationally, their integration culturally, their integration religiously. We find them slowly building the house of their existence. Not only the physical house, for this was still a period of wandering, but a house of convictions, a house of social and psychic patterns, preparing the way, recognizing the need, testing and trying and proving their own development. This book, Exodus particularly, is one of the most powerful historical and psychological documents in the entire Bible, where it supports the general belief of the modern sociologist that the only way in which revelation is possible is through the gradual unfoldment of the native psychic entity of a people. That these people must bring forth from themselves that which is necessary to them. The revelation is therefore released. That it is knowledge, wisdom, understanding, moving through a people, binding them, uniting them, and holding them into a gradually integrating pattern. This integrating pattern we see gradually take form. We have it interrupted by innumerable side deviations from the principal text. But by the time we end the study of the Exodus, we see a people emerging into a nation, into a united, cooperative unit, a people forming a body. And as the body of man must pass through its infancy and through its early growth before it is capable of sustaining the soul within it, before the soul power is capable of moving through it and releasing itself. So, in the story of the Exodus, we find the gradual integration of the collective or of the individual psyche. It's moving towards sufficiency and security suitable to receive further knowledge. And this leads inevitably into the third book, which is the Leviticus. And the Leviticus is nothing more or less than the immediate unfolding of the Levitical ministry as such. And here we find the body of the law slowly taking upon itself its own psychic nature. We find the law becoming the vehicle for the actual presence of an indwelling or an internal truth. We find, for example, the Shekinah column gradually moving. We see the integration of the tabernacle mysteries. We see the Spirit of the Lord hovering over the mercy seat. We know the Shekinah glory. And we know that the worship of the great archangel Michael, who was the psychopompous of heaven and the secret God of Israel, was gradually taking shape. So in the Leviticus, we find the more complete, almost complete, revelation of the whole code, insofar as that code could be sustained and supported by these people. It was the motion of the people toward the integration of their great religious mystery system. It was in the cycle of Leviticus that we find the beginnings of the Kabbalah, beginnings of secret knowledge, beginnings of the wisdom that is only for those who have advanced in the apperception of mysteries. So out of the people we find a priesthood. And what is a priesthood? Ever. The priesthood is always simply the symbolical pattern of man's own psychic possession. The soul within man is his priesthood. And the collective soul of a people is its priesthood, which must guard, lead, and direct the spiritual and material destiny of that people. So in Leviticus, the old dispensation, the law of the Pentateuch, is in soul and becomes a living thing. The breath of life, in the form of the great religious overtones, are bestowed, and the people is consecrated. It is united as one body of the Lord, as the hands and feet of the Eternal. Now, in this also, we have a further problem. For as soon as man's psychic life integrates, what happens? Does he immediately become happy? Unfortunately not. It is not that easy. The moment the individual takes control of his own spiritual life and his own destiny from within himself, he faces the most difficult situation he has ever faced in his life. He faces what has been called the desert. This is the great place of wandering. So that we have, inevitably, Leviticus leading to Numbers. Numbers, which is that part which essentially deals with the story of the great sorrow in the wilderness, the great struggle, the struggle against worldliness, the struggle between the rising power of internal light and the darkness of environment. For it is only when the soul is enlightened that it is aware of the conflict or the contrast between itself and that which is not itself, that which constitutes the period in the wilderness. Therefore, the story, as we find it in Numbers, is like the initiation ritual of one of the old mysteries. It is the story of man's wandering. It is the prodigal son seeking again his father's house. It is also the story of Parsifal, the guileless fool, who, having forgotten or lost the way to the temple of Mount Allah, must wander in black armor for many years, seeking again his own mysterious spiritual heritage. This wandering through the desert is the substance and burden of the Odyssey and the Iliad, because in the return of Ulysses or Odysseus to his own far distant native land, we find the story of the journey of the soul through the wilderness. And among the Pietists of provincial Pennsylvania, here among the Dutch people, they had a society which was called the Society of the Woman of the Wilderness. And it represented the concept of human travail in darkness seeking for truth. This is essentially the story of the wandering of the tribes of Israel. And when we recognize, for instance, that the 12 tribes can symbolize the 12 convolutions of the human brain, and consequently all of the attributes of man's thought and emotion, we can see why the wanderings of these through the wilderness of ignorance is an almost inevitable prerequisite to the attainment of wisdom and security. We have, therefore, this symbolic pattern moving through. But the great and wonderful point in connection with this phase of the story is the revelation of the law to Moses on Mount Sinai. Now, of course, the biblical account of this is comparatively abridged. But there is much more to be found in the old Jewish tradition than has ever been brought out and brought to the consideration of non-Jewish scholars. According to the old tradition, Moses ascended Mount Sinai three times. On the first ascent of the mountain, he was given the Torah. And the Torah is the law. The Torah is the essential statute. It is the root and source of the great Babylonian and Jerusalem Talmuds, the great combinations and collections of the law. It is a tremendous revelation of jurisprudence, and probably one of the greatest and deepest of all legal codes. The Mosaic law was for the government of people. It was for the government of a wild and nomadic people. And yet it drew them and brought them under the recognition that civil law and religious law are the same thing, that there was no essential division between them, and that by keeping faith with each other, they kept faith with God. But there could be no deviation. Man could not break civil law without breaking sacred law. We have gradually divided this habit. Therefore, we today say that to break a civil law is a crime, to break a religious law is a sin. But in ancient times, there was no division between these. That which was a crime was a sin, and vice versa. So the great code, the Torah, was revealed to Moses on the first ascent of Mount Sinai and required the 40 days and 40 nights. He then ascended the mountain a second time. And on the second ascent, he was given the Mishnah, which is one of the more mystical and secret writings of the Jews. The Mishnah is called the soul of the law. The Torah is the body of the law. The Mishnah is also a work of instruction suitable for the priest, particularly, but also available to the people. And it is called the soul of the law. And it is intimately associated with the ancient statement, the body or letter of the law killeth, but the spirit of the law giveth life. Therefore, the Mishnah was the soul or spirit of the law which gave life. Now, what is life in this sense? In the Mishnah, we learn that life is understanding, and that the cold letter of the law becomes warm with life when we understand the reason for the obedience that is required. That when we understand fully and completely, we no longer fear the law, but recognize it as the greater good. Therefore, our fear is gradually transformed into respect. And the Mishnah, which gives man the internal understanding of the Torah, and brings this law to life in him and for him, causing it to become a directive of a conduct pattern based upon a rich and warm ideal. This is properly and appropriately called the soul of the doctrine. This is the law for those who are learning, for the thoughtful. But we would say today that it is the revelation of the law for the individual who wishes to live better than upon the surface of things. We might term it mystical, philosophical. We might conceive it as even to be psychological, because it is something which makes things more real, more true, more valuable. ascended the mountain and remained again for 40 days and 40 nights, he received the Kabbalah, the secret doctrine of Israel, the spirit of the law. He received in this way the great keys to the revelation. And in the Christian dispensation, the papal keys, which were supposed to have been presented to St. Peter, consisted of a silver and a golden key, and they are crossed on the papal arms even today. Well, the silver key is the Kabbalah of Moses. The silver key is the mysterious wisdom which unlocks all of the mysteries of the Old Testament. The golden key is the symbol, in this case, of the key which unlocks the mysteries of the Messianic dispensation. So the gold key unlocks the mystery of the law. The golden key unlocks the mystery of grace. And the law and the grace are the two great columns represented by the campanella on the fronts of churches. In Notre Dame de Paris, there are the two great towers. One is the power of the prophets, and the other is the power of grace. But man shall enter in between law and grace, which is appropriate and proper to this mystery. Moses, in receiving the Kabbalah, received the great keys of Gematria and Notaricum, the methods of unlocking the secret riddle. He became aware of the meanings of all of the words. And he received also the Sefer Hedibrin, the book of the words, by means of which all of these mysterious terms can be unlocked. He was then in the position that is described a little later in the early medieval period by Rabbi Moses ben Maimon, known better as Maimonides, the great Jewish teacher and pre-scholastic. He declared that the mysteries of truth, like the human body, consist of three parts. First, there is the garment which conceals the body. This is the Torah. This is the body of the law. Then there is the body which is contained within the garment. This is the Mishnah, which is the soul. And then there is a life which is contained within the body. And this is the innermost. And this is the Kabbalah. And as of man, so of wisdom, it must be threefold in three parts. Its inner part veiled by its outer members. And its outer part are for all. The parts are for all. But the inner part is only for Ashkenaz, those who have dedicated eternally to the service of God. And the revelation of the Mishnah is through the prophets. And the revelation of the Kabbalah is through the saints, or through the holy ones who have been sent by special revelation. And it is said in the old verse later that the secrets of the Kabbalah were entrusted to Solomon, king of Israel. And we want to pause here just a moment, because in referring to Pentateuch, we are referring to the five books of Moses. And we are well aware, and the question has recently been asked us, what of the sixth and seventh books of Moses? There are two books that are generally found in paper binding and are catchpenny publications that are called the sixth and seventh books of Moses. And we must pause for a moment on this particular subject. Because of the nature of the Jewish doctrine and the Jewish revelation, and because of its tremendous emphasis upon the septenarial division of the universe, there is a very ancient legend that the original books of Moses were seven, and that two were concealed or hidden. This was because man has five vowels, and a sixth and seventh partial vowel, represented today by two consonants, with partly vowel sounds. There is a sixth and seventh vowel. Man has five senses. But there is a sixth and seventh sense concealed within him, not yet developed. Also, in the Bodhisattva doctrine of Northern Buddhism, the Mahayana system, there are five Jnana Buddhas, but there are two others hidden. For in the ancient system, there were always five revealed and two concealed. And the ancient said that this was according to the law and the body. For in man, there were supposedly five vital parts revealed and superseded. And in the life of man, there are five parts which are regarded as perfect and two which are regarded as imperfect. And the creation itself requires 7 days. And all of these working together would lead to the assumption that the great Kabbalistic schools from which the Mosaic doctrines originally received their form and final presentation may very well have possessed what were called the sixth and seventh books of Moses. There also are, according to the Oriental anthropologists, there are five races upon the earth, and a sixth and seventh yet to come. In the old system of astronomy, not our present system, there were five planets, a sun and moon, or two luminaries, which substituted for two physical planets which we have later discovered. The ancients knew they existed, but did not desire to reveal that. So this concealment of two in the midst of five is a very ancient formula of Kabbalah and related material. In this concept, it was believed that the sixth and seventh books of Moses were held in secret by a mysterious order which arose among the ancient Jews, and that these two books, because of the final failure of man to meet the challenge of the dispensation, were taken back to the heavenly college by the angel Raziel, and are no longer upon the earth, because man was not yet worthy of them. But that in the fullness of time, these other two books would come and would be revealed. And of course, the seventh book is the famous book without words, because on the seventh day is the great rest, or the Sabbath, or the eternal silence. So that the seventh book is the book of the great silence, the seals of which may never be opened. But what we call today the sixth and seventh books of Moses, and what are now in circulation, are really, I hate to say it because I'm not of a critical mind normally, they're just old-fashioned forgeries. They arose at a time in the medieval period when men's minds were greatly involved in witchcraft. And witchcraft and demonology did arise among the Jewish communities after the diaspora, or the scattering of Israel. Therefore, in the old Polish synagogues and in various parts of Europe, there were old rabbins who followed ceremonial magic, who tried to raise spirits like Faust of old. And very good play dealing with that subject has been very popular in this country. It is called the Devil. And this is a story of the enchantment, of witchcraft, of the spelling of spirits. And it's not at all unlike corresponding stories found in the annals of the Inquisition, like the Maleficarum and other similar parables. But the sixth and seventh books of Moses are in the class of grimoires, or books of magical formulas. They have no basic origin in the original doctrine. They would rather be said to be perversions or degenerations of the great basic principles of ceremonial magic. Ceremonial magic was part of Kabbalah. Ceremonial magic dealt with man's ability to control the powers of the universe. But these secrets were never revealed, and they cannot be bought for 25 cents in the nearest newsstand, I assure you. And I wouldn't become at all excited over the process. I'll return again for a moment to the story of Moses. One of the important things that we learn concerning the story of Moses are certain legends relating to the revelation of the tablets of the law on Sinai. These revelations tell us that the two tablets of the law were what was called in that time the male and female tablets. In other words, one tablet had letters raised upon it and the other had letters engraved into it, so that when the two halves of the tablet met, they became one solid stone. We are now assuming, of course, that on these tablets were originally written the Ten Commandments as we know. That is not essentially true. but they were not so inscribed. In the oldest known form, the tablets contained two columns of letters, each tablet with five letters. These letters, in turn, contained the stenographic abridgments of certain words from which other combinations could be made. At another time, they contained the 10 names of the Sephiroth, or the tree of creation, the 10 names of the 10 worlds, to each one of which a law or a certain truth was intrinsic. These tables were originally, it is said, upon a transparent stone. And this transparent stone, according to one account at least, was given to Moses by God out of a mysterious abode in heaven, and it was called a sapphire. It was an enormous sapphire. And when Moses broke these tablets, and in his repentance, he sought to restore them, he could not. Therefore, he copied the letters upon tables of stone. But the jewel which had been given to him in heaven had been shattered and lost, and the parts of it were returned to God. So this man had not the original revelation, but carvings of it upon stone. Therefore, according to the ancient Jewish tradition, we have to understand that by the inscription upon stone, we represent the material law. The law which says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But that the law of mercy, because man had perverted it, was restored to heaven to wait for a better time. All of these little interludes coming into this story give it a great deal of richness and color and tremendous overtone, moral significance, spiritual mystery. Also, it is said that when Moses ascended the mountain, he found upon the top of the mountain a great cloud. And as he approached it, the cloud opened. And he saw in the cloud, in the form of the cloud, a great cave leading apparently far into the sky, a cave of clouds. And in this cave, a great light hovered and floated, and from the light came the voice that instructed him. And as we study the story very definitely, we study Mount Sinai, and we compare it with all the world mountains and all the great religious hills and the mountains from which cometh our help. And we know that what Moses is trying to tell us is the story of an internal spiritual experience. And that the entire story deals with man's retiring into the innermost part of himself. There is an early work on Jewish anatomy, which was circulated in Spain during the 15th century, which shows the world distributed on the human body. And in this arrangement, Mount Sinai is located in the heart. Therefore, we are beginning to sense that in the wandering of the wilderness, that this mountain of help or strength is the heart, and that the heart again later becomes the symbol for the Ark of the Covenant and for the other mysterious symbols which are associated with the Jewish religious symbols. Thus Moses is telling us of a retirement into the innermost nature and the deeper parts of his own being. And the historical mountain is only a symbol of this other mountain. And Mount Ararat, upon which the ark descended, is also a symbolical mountain. For it is the mountain upon which the spiritual life of the race finally touches its material foundation. And in all these, like the Septapana cave of the illumination of Buddha, in the room, the house of seven rooms, it is the heart. And in one of the old Egyptian manuscripts, we are told that the Great Pyramid was the heart which was set up in Egypt. So we have the mountain, the pyramid, the mound, all symbolizing the sanctuary of God. And that this sanctuary is essentially always symbolic of the human heart. So Moses enters into the holy place, into the high place of his own consciousness, into the aloneness and the aloofness. He transcends the world, he rises above mortal things, and there in an inner mystery he receives the inward impression of the tables of the law. But when he trusts this impression to his mind and his outer personality, he cannot express it. He destroys it. He is unable to reveal it. All he can make is a copy of the stone. And each of us who has ever had a very great and beautiful thought within ourselves knows what that means.
we try so desperately to give that thought, to share that thought, that all we can pass on is a hollow, stone-like symbol of it, because the reality simply cannot be captured within our own experience. There is a very wonderful story relating to Moses at the time of the wars of Israel. And at that time, Moses went up to a hill, and he was old, and he could not stand long. Therefore, a stone, a rough stone, was placed for him to sit on. And on each side of Moses stood one of the great elders of the people of Israel. On one side stood Aaron, the priest. And on the other side stood Ehud, the general of the armies. And it was the law of that battle that as long as Moses' arms were held up, the children of Israel would be victorious. But the moment his arms fell, the enemy would win. Now Moses was old, and he could not hold up his arms. So Aaron upon one side, and Ehud upon the other side, held up his arms for the day. And when night nearly came, and the battle was not decided, Moses asked the Lord to extend the day until the battle was concluded. And on that occasion, the day was extended. And it was again extended in the time of Joshua, who was caused to make the sun stand still. But the story of Moses and his arms being upheld by Aaron and Hur is very, very interesting, because Moses is the law. If men uphold the law, they are victorious. If they allow the law to fall or to fail, all is lost. So that the priesthood upon the one side, which is religion, and the general of the armies, which is man's knowledge, his science, his material attainments, both of these must sustain the law, one on each side. And if they sustain the law, the armies of Israel will be victorious over the kings who would otherwise destroy them. And in this we have, of course, another evidence, a symbolic evidence, that we are referring primarily to Moses, as the embodiment of a great hope. Who keeps the law is kept by the law. Who breaks the law perishes from the law. And in this, the law of the prophets are fulfilled. So in these five books, we have the evolution or the development of these five steps. We have in the last book, Deuteronomy, we have the three great discourses of Moses, in which he gives to his people the full, now a mature reflection of the law. He shows the law in its most natural nature, at one moment firm and relentless, at another moment kind and gentle, sometimes apparently harsh and tyrannical, sometimes appearing to work for darkness, at other times with every solicitude for the most sensitive and tender consideration. And thus is how, this is how we see the law, one moment as a tyrant and one moment as a benefactor. And having given his final instruction to his people, or revealed itself or himself through this great priesthood which he created, Moses, because he was not yet perfect, was not able to go as far as the people he was leading. And so he went to sleep on the hills of Moab, and the place knew him no more. But we have here a wonderful inner statement. The law is in us. The law is in Eldad, a strange deep prophet, a patriarch, a voice of strength which comes through us in our own instincts. We are the children of Israel wandering in the wilderness. We have within ourselves, we have the ancient one, the law, the tradition of our kind. And in the mosaic of dispensation, the emphasis is upon the great body of the law that has descended to us. It is the law that has come from the experience of our people, the experience of our race, from the traditions of the good and the wise and the true. And in each one of us, there is an archetypal form of law, an archetypal form which has come within our own consciousness and our own understanding. It is the law of the folk. It is the law of the race, the law of the kind. We are born in it. It is in our blood. It comes down to us from the first nutrition that we receive from our mothers. It is the law of our kind. It is the law of the jungle or the plain of the desert. It is the law that the animal and man both must obey. And this is the old law, the law which goes on forever, apparently, represented by this, the patriarchal concept. Now it is against this law, against the strange severity of it,
that we find the rise of the Messianic tradition, not only among Christians, but also among the Jewish people themselves. For the law led inevitably to the prophets. And because the prophets were the ones who broke through the law, because the prophets were the ones who had the vision of a great release from the concept of law as dominance, release from the law as strength or pressure. It was because of that that the prophets began to sing. It was because of this release that we have Isaiah. It is because of the problem, the burden of it, that we have Jehovah. It also is the burden of the release of Ezekiel. And we find something of this new note, this new tremendous power in the songs of Ruth and Esther. So that from the law, a people passes inevitably. From the acceptance, from obedience, from domination, towards a mystical release. And this mystical release, we begin to consider in what we term the prophetic voice. And I think that's about enough for one evening.